I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this week on Two Jewish is Andrew Coe and Jane Ziegelman, authors of A Square Meal. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavena on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are now halfway through the final month of the Jewish calendar, Elul, which means Rosh Hashanah is just 2 weeks away, 2 weeks from tonight. This is the time of year in Jewish tradition when we examine our lives in the past year, think about how we've lived, and decide how we can improve and change in the coming 5777 year. Change is always challenging, even when it's change for the better. Generally speaking, it's easier to do the same things over again the same way we've done them. We already know how to do what we've done, after all, and even if the results aren't fulfilling or meaningful, they are predictable. That's why so many of us find it nearly impossible to make significant changes in our personal lives and behavior. We somehow think that if we just keep doing what we've been doing, we will succeed this time. The great Jewish physicist Albert Einstein defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And isn't that what most of us choose to do in our lives? As we move into the home stretch of 5776, the danger is that we'll continue to do what we've always done and arrive next year at Rosh Hashanah to discover that we've made the same mistakes and failed to improve. If that proves to be the case, we will have wasted the opportunity to make our lives better, more meaningful, and holier. We will have failed in an essential purpose of life. This special time of year gives us a chance to choose to live better, more sacred, more valuable lives. All we need to do is look in the mirror honestly and see reflected there someone who has the capacity to become more than he or she was over the past 12 months. That someone, of course, is you, and you are the one who has to make it all happen. The first step in this season of the year, in this prelude to Rosh Hashanah, is to apologize to anyone you've offended or hurt. Try it today. Call somebody you should have called already, or somebody you've ignored when they needed you. Find a person you wronged and try to make it up to them. Reach out. Do something caring for someone who cannot benefit you. It's all part of the process we call tshuva in Judaism, return and repentance. It's a great process, if sometimes a challenging one, and it can lead to real growth and return. It's the best and sometimes the only way to make our lives better in the coming Jewish year. To play us in this morning on this theme of tshuva, here's cantor Shmuel Barzilai, the chief cantor of Vienna, Austria, singing Areshet Sfatenu from the Rosh Hashanah Shofar service, Open Our Lips to Praise You, God.
Areshet, Areshet Sfatenu, Areshet Sfatenu,
Maybe no mazin, maybe too much.
That was Aresh Tzfatenu for the coming Jewish High Holy Days, beginning with Rosh Hashanah 2 weeks from tonight. Stop by a temple, like my own Temple Emmanuel, and arrange to be there. Be our guest, as we like to say. Our guests this morning on Too Jewish, Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Koh, are authors with a unique ability to bring together food and history, two very Jewish subjects, by the way. Their new book, A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression, has a lot to teach us about the ways our society changed, and something we Jews have long known, how important food is in shaping culture. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
It's everything you wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's Taste of Judaism program is now in its 17th year and explores Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community. This free introductory class taught by our rabbis is immensely popular throughout southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, Taste of Judaism brings to life Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. It'll help you rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all and include Jewish snacks. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year at Splendido as well. The whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class, starting soon. It's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email Mila, M-I-L-A, at tetucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guests this morning, Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Koh. They're the authors of a new book, A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. Jane Ziegelman is the author of the widely acclaimed 97 Orchard, an edible history of 5 immigrant families in 1 New York tenement. She curates food events for the Tenement Museum in New York. And Andrew Koh is also a writer and an independent scholar specializing in culinary history. His Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States, was a finalist, for the James Beard Award. And they're married to each other and live in Brooklyn. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So why write about a period when people had the worst food, or at least access to the most difficulty accessing ingredients? We think of the Depression as a hungry time.
Well, I think the main reason is because this was the period we realized when food was topic A for millions and millions of Americans, the question of how to get good food on the table. And so food, unlike any other period before or since, was a main topic of debate. And we also realized that food, this was like a turning point in American food history, when we went from being a country where still a lot of 19th century traditions were alive and well on people's tables. And by the end of the Great Depression, we were moving into the modern food technology, big business world that we live in today. So it was like a crucial turning point in American eating, and we realized this was, nobody had written about it, and it was a great topic.
There's a great scene in which Franklin Roosevelt, who was a patrician from a rich family, old money, sits down in the White House to a meal, a very humble meal. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, this was the doing of his wife, Eleanor, who was active in the home economics movement. And the home economics movement during this time was endorsing a new kind of scientific budget cooking that would allow impoverished Americans to get the nutrition they needed at greatly reduced costs. And Eleanor wanted to play sort of gastronomic role model to the country, and thought she should serve the president what the poor folk are eating out in the country, and gave him for his lunch that day an entree of deviled eggs with tomato sauce, a side of mashed potatoes, and then for dessert, a serving of prune pudding.
Prune pudding.
Indeed.
Yeah. We haven't seen that much on the... haven't seen that lot on a lot of menus in fine restaurants lately. How did it all taste?
Well, we have made prune pudding using the recipe that was used to serve FDR. And prune pudding, it's a little bit viscous. But sort of once you get past that, it has a kind of nice flavor. I'd give it a try.
We will talk much more with Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Coe about A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression, and find out what cooking under extreme circumstances can do when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes. The base ingredients, the propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. We now have about a month and a half until we elect a new president of the United States, and we continue our 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. Hillary Clinton is clobbering Donald Trump among Florida Jewish voters by a 41-point margin if this were a two-way race, according to the latest poll. The Democratic presidential nominee is polling at 67% among the critical Jewish voting demographic, compared to her Republican rival, Trump, who has secured just 26% of the vote among likely Jewish voters. His support drops to 23% in a poll that accounts for third-party candidates. The Jewish community is about 5% of Florida's total voting population. Florida remains a crucial swing state in this election. 3 out of 4 Jewish voters have serious concerns that Trump is fostering anti-Semitism and other forces threatening to Jews. Only Orthodox Jews favor Trump in Florida, while all other Jewish sectors, Reform, Conservative, Secular, and so on, are going very heavily for Clinton. Mitt Romney drew 31% of the Jewish vote in Florida in 2012, but he still lost the state. Trump is well behind that total. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking in this month of the 15th anniversary of 9/11 about terrorism. We started talking last week in depth about the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia over 50 years and some of the very negative effects it's had on our United States reputation in the Arab world and the Muslim world in general. Let's dig a little deeper.
Well, we traditionally have 2 strong allies in that part of the world, and occasionally we've had other ones of a less durable nature, but our 2 strong allies have been Israel and Saudi Arabia. And our support for those governments or those regimes has been largely unconditional, with, you know, occasional words of criticism or little prodding toward the Saudis to improve human rights or little urging of the Israelis to modify the settlements policy, whatever.
And then but sometimes personal differences between the president and the prime minister or a king or something, but it's been pretty minimal.
Right. And ironically, relations between our 2 staunchest and most durable allies in that part of the world have historically not been good, to put it mildly. In fact, the Saudis, I think, technically were still in a state of war against Israel that started in 1948 and was never terminated. But recently,
we're working on becoming the new 100 years war.
Right. Recently, as you pointed out, there have been signs of a slight evolution in the Saudi position towards Israel. Maybe you want to address that in some detail.
I think for the first time, it started a couple of years ago. We've reported that here on Two Jewish and Bits and Pieces. You start to see positive mentions about things going on in Israel and very negative stuff in the official Saudi press. I don't think there's any unofficial Saudi press about Hamas, about the war in Gaza, about ISIS, and kind of grudgingly positive things about Israel. And there's now talk about a strategic alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia, in part because of Iran, in part both opposed to Iran, and in part because of ISIS and other radical terrorist movements in the area.
Right. Well, I think it's fair to say that both countries share a fear of Shiites, a fear of extremists, a fear of terrorism, and mostly a fear of disorder and chaos. So one reason that the Saudis for a long time actively sought to undermine any prospect of peace between Israel and the Arab world, or any sort of talks and constructive agreements like the Oslo Accords, whatever, was that the Saudis value stability, predictability, and order. And they saw democracy as being chaotic. They saw a multi-party state like Israel as being chaotic and unpredictable. And they particularly feared the Palestinians, many of whom have been educated in the West or have exposure to Israeli-style democracy or European-style democracy. And they feared that if the Palestinians got a state of their own, it would be a source of chaos, disorder, and democratization in the heart of the Arab world. So they undermined every chance that there was historically over a period of decades to create a truly independent, viable Palestinian democracy. That is now starting to shift for a number of reasons that I guess we need to discuss next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
Look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na on Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm well. BDS has been very much in the news, increasingly from an Israeli perspective on campuses in America, but really in Europe. Interesting news.
Yes, and we talked about it, that it's been more than a decade that Europe developed a disturbing obsession about Israel and about the Jews. And we already talked about BDS here before, but actually last week, I think it was last week, or that Sweden in Stockholm, they hold like a rally for Israel. And it was the first time that official senior Israeli representative participated. And I think we talked before how Israel was at the beginning of, you know, like 10 years ago, kind of, you know, we don't care, it's nonsense. But so it's really, again, tipping point that an Israeli official participate in this rally. And it was symbolic that it took place in the Raoul Valberg Square, who is Hasid Umot HaOlam.
Yeah, he was one of the righteous Gentiles,
yes,
who saved so many Jews during the Holocaust,
yes,
and then was killed, as we found out, not terribly long ago in the Soviet prison after the war.
Yes, and Yair Lapid opened his speech with saying that Raoul Valberg actually saved his father's life, Tommy Lapid. And
that's a famous story. It's an incredible story, right?
Yeah, and he said, you know, now the politician in Sweden are in the wrong side of the map, wrong side of the history, and it includes all kind of, you know, we talked about it before, about how the United Nations Human Rights Committee condemned Israel, and it was fascinating because this committee condemned Israel like not just more than the Syrian president Bashar Assad, who kills 400,000 of his own people, or, you know, those who are responsible for the genocide in Sudan, or for Hezbollah and Hamas, who are killing our children, using their own children as a human shield. You know, and it's really fascinating that Israel being condemned more of all of this together.
Yeah,
and
more than all of these genocidal maniacs.
And his point and my point, and I think everyone's point, is it's not criticism anymore. It's definitely anti-Semitism. Because, you know, I don't know that I need to add anything.
No, I think that's clear. And actually in Malmo, there's been some terrible incidents in Sweden itself. So it's great to see a rally that includes an important Israeli addressing the
problem. Yeah,
the
it was attended by hundreds, and also some local governors from Sweden. And actually, it was taking place in Sweden because lately we heard more disturbing, you know, comments from local politicians,
right,
like the Sarat Achutz, the Minister of
Foreign Ministry,
Affairs,
right,
that asked to investigate Israel about, you know, for all the crimes, like lately in the last wave of terror. So she really, that's what she asked, like in the past few months,
right,
again and again, to investigate because Israel kills innocent kids.
Innocent
that,
kids,
you know,
who, by the way, had knives or guns
again,
and were attacking
that,
somebody, right?
They have a very clear mission, right, to kill Israeli kids or Israeli innocent people.
Right. No, it's good to see that. And I think it's important that Israel address some of the Hasbara problems in Europe, not just in America, which Israel, it's good to see them much more proactive about,
mm-hmm,
it. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
Rabbi.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, the head of Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Hello. Boker Or.
Jewish history is a long history of persecution. We always talk about that.
Yeah.
But the truth is, there's a great deal of joy in Judaism. When, mm-hmm, you're teaching Judaism,
mm-hmm,
how do you get away from all of the memories of pain and,
right,
persecution and Holocaust and make it a joyful experience? Because kids relate to joy.
Absolutely. And there is so much joy in living Judaism. We have a long memory as a people, and, you know, we don't forget our hurts, which has a lot of value because we need to remember the people and those experiences. But on the other hand, we don't want to get bogged down in the negative. Life is hard. Life is challenging. It's hard being a parent. It's hard being a teacher. It's hard being a head of school and a rabbi. I know the people listening,
especially this time of year, I might add.
I know our listeners have their own hardships, you know, and so it is essential to teach the value of joy and celebration and positivity. In fact, one of our themes right now across the school, K-8, is positivity. We have a program called Attitude that's a homegrown program, which teaches a handful of specific values over the course of the year, but was inspired
by Anna Greenberg.
By Anna Greenberg, a tragic situation, right? Horrible fight with cancer.
But that, I knew her well, and an unbelievably energetic, positive person.
Positive all the way through. And because of the way she modeled that positivity, this program was created, I mean, literally. And so how do we teach being positive? Well, we talk about paying a compliment. We talk about recognizing something good. We talk about finding something that's going right in your day and putting that energy and that juice, as I call it, that thinking, that heart into that appreciation and really being mindful of being in that space.
You know, I think of the great teaching. We always think about the Ol HaTorah, the yoke, the burden of Torah, but there's also the flip side of that, which is the Simcha Shel Mitzvah, the joy in fulfilling commandment.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have arguably the funniest people in the world. Right.
Oh, all of them, frankly, are Jewish. I mean, there's a few that are African American.
The Marx
let's be honest,
Brothers,
but, and occasional
Larry
Latino,
David.
But mostly they're Jewish.
Right.
And Mark Twain, right? That's
true. You look at sitcoms. I mean, American comedy, amazingly Jewish, and it comes from our story. It comes from our passion of celebration. It comes from our backpack of guilt and tzuras, and that also that negative side. But we are a people of celebration. So it's a learned thing. You learn to be positive. You learn not to be positive. So when we teach kids about positivity, we get real tangible. Find something that somebody did in class today. Write them a little note celebrating them. So third grade just did this exercise. I got a Post-it note. And it was great. I didn't expect
nice.
It. So it's those tangible, let's make it real. Let's not just talk about it or assume that it's happening, but you really are intentional and purposeful and mindful, and you promote it like other things. And then it becomes
you teach the value of Judaism, and you teach the value of what's going on.
Part of living Judaism and doing those celebrations. What a great opportunity to enjoy and celebrate.
Thanks, John. We will talk next week.
Okay. Keep it positive, everybody.
When we return on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A popular young teacher tells her third grade class that she is an atheist. She then asks if there are any other atheists in the class. Not knowing what an atheist is, they're third graders, but wanting to please their teacher, all but one of them immediately put up their hands. The exception is young Sarah. The teacher asks Sarah why she wants to be different from all the other kids. "Because I'm not an atheist," Sarah replies. "So what are you then?" asks the teacher. "I'm Jewish," she says proudly. The teacher asks Sarah why she is Jewish. "My mother is Jewish and my father is Jewish, so I'm Jewish," Sarah says. "That's not a good enough reason," the teacher says. "What if your mom was a moron and your dad was a moron? What would you be then?" Well, then I'd be an atheist, says Sarah. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tavo in Deuteronomy, which begins with an unusual declaration. When we come into the land the Lord our God will give us as an inheritance, we are to take the first fruits of our produce and bring them to the priests and say, Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean. He came to Egypt, few in number, became a great nation there. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us, enslaved us. But God brought us out with a great hand and an outstretched arm, brought us to this place, flowing with milk and honey. In addition to its central role in an important biblical ritual, this passage was quoted often in rabbinic literature. It's most famously said on the Pesach Haggadah on Passover. But the formula for what we're supposed to say when we bring our offering to the tabernacle is surprising. It's a mini-history of our ancient people, and it includes two of the most important elements in our people's history, the Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, and the entry into and settlement of Eretz Yisrael, the homeland of Israel. But it curiously omits all mention of a third equally crucial event, the giving of Torah at Sinai, the Ten Commandments. This is a fascinating, even a shocking omission. If the three most important elements of Jewish identity are God, Torah, and Israel, omitting Torah means having an incomplete form of Judaism. Ironically, here in the Torah itself, what is missing is Torah. One explanation for this Ki Tavo omission teaches us much about how religion evolves, what an organic, remarkable creation Judaism really is. In biblical times, our people constituted an agricultural nation, living on and with the land. The most important religious experiences were farming-related, planting crops, harvesting, dividing the produce, offering it, eating it. The connection to the land itself, the labor needed to produce food from it, was central to our identity. Eretz Yisrael was truly the Holy Land of Israel, and our intimate and permanent relationship to that land was forged over centuries of daily labor and life. When Zionism reconnected Jews to the land in the 19th century in a real, tangible, practical way, it revived the whole experience of loving and serving God by creating food from the very earth, Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. The land of Israel was at the heart of our people, and it is also at the heart of Ki Tavo, as we hope it is at the heart of every Jew in the world today. Like Eretz Yisrael, the land, God too was central to Jewish life in the times of the Bible. In Ki Tavo, we are commanded to bring this offering to God in the tabernacle, later the temple, and to thank God for all we have. We are to remember the great gift of freedom God conferred upon us by miraculously redeeming us from Egyptian slavery. Everything comes from God, a good lesson today as in the time of Deuteronomy. So we have God and Israel, but not Torah. Clearly, the third leg of this stool of Jewish identity, Torah, was far less crucial to our ancestors in Deuteronomy than the other two. But why? Well, as farmers in our own land, the need to study Torah in whatever form it existed must have seemed less urgent. We had an immediate relationship with the land. We needed God for the basics that make agriculture possible, rain, sun, soil. The importance of Torah was diminished when we lived on the land. But when we went into exile and were forcibly torn from our land of Israel, we needed Torah. In fact, without Torah, Judaism would have disappeared. The people of Israel faded into the dust of history. Torah preserved us, gave us the moral foundation, the religious identity, not only to survive, but thrive. When we read Ki Tavo, in the Torah, of course, we are to give a tenth of all that we have earned to charity, to the poor, homeless, widow, and orphan. We acknowledge that we have been blessed. We are following an ancient agricultural practice, maybe more than 3,000 years old, designed for a people in a land of long ago. But we are also using this remarkable text, Torah, to teach us how to live today. And therein lies the true genius of Judaism. For wherever we are in the world, it is the Torah that binds us together and makes possible our unity as a people. It is the Torah that reminds us to worship God and of our connection to the Holy Land of Israel. It is the Torah that teaches us that tzedakah must be part and parcel of our very being. Paradoxically, even when the Torah seems to be absent, as it appears to be here in Ki Tavo, it is not only implicitly present, but central, in our religion and in our lives. May we always remember that. May it always be so. Our guests on Too Jewish this morning, Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Coe, have written a fascinating history of the Depression from a culinary standpoint. It's the era when home economics became a national obsession, and changes in food and eating that it entailed are entertainingly conveyed in their new book, A Square Meal. Find out the ways the Depression continues to influence your dinner table today when we return right here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel's former prime minister and president, Shimon Peres, suffered a serious stroke last week after an operation to insert a cardiac pacemaker. Peres is 93 years old. Director General Professor Kreis of the hospital said that Shimon Peres has suffered lots of bleeding. The ninth president of the State of Israel, Shimon Peres, suffered a major stroke. He is being treated by the best doctors in the hospital from across the medical fields. He underwent a number of scans. He is in intensive care. We are monitoring him constantly. Peres' son, Chemi, asked people to pray for his father as he spoke to reporters. Shimon Peres is truly the last of a great generation of Israeli leaders who helped lead the country to independence and develop the institutions of the State of Israel. He was the founding father of the Israeli Air Force, was the key figure in the development of Israel's nuclear capacity. Peres served as prime minister on three different occasions, once unofficially. He won the Nobel Peace Prize along with Yitzhak Rabin in 1994 for the Oslo Accords and was an extremely effective president, largely a ceremonial office for others, from 2007 to 2014. While his left-of-center parties were often defeated very narrowly in national elections they were expected to win, Peres is an extremely important figure of both Israeli and international importance throughout history. Our prayers are with Shimon Peres and his family. In Washington, D.C., the United States and Israel signed a defense aid agreement last week that promises Israel $38 billion over 10 years from 2019 through 2028. We affirm today the unbreakable bond between the United States and Israel, said U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice at the Washington ceremony. On behalf of President Obama, we are all thinking of and praying for Shimon Peres, Israel's national treasure. Since 2009, Rice continued, the U.S. has provided almost $24 billion in military aid to Israel. We are proud that no other administration has done so much to enhance Israel's security. We can't know what will happen in the next 10 years, but we do know the U.S. will always be there for Israel. Israel's acting National Security Advisor, Jacob Nagel, spoke, saying that Israel does not take the military aid package for granted. Senior U.S. officials also said that in the event of an emergency, like war, the U.S. would be prepared to consider increasing the budget for missile defense systems beyond what is promised in the agreement, as it has done in the past. The Defense Assistance Pact, which has been negotiated intensively since last November, was signed at the State Department by Nagel and U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon, Jr. Also present were U.S. Ambassador to Israel Dan Shapiro and Israeli Ambassador to the U.S. Ron Dermer. In L.A., liberal crusader Stanley Scheinbaum, a wealthy retired economics professor who worked for liberal candidates and causes and dauntlessly injected himself into political controversies home and abroad, died at the age of 96. Stanley Scheinbaum, a transplanted New York Jew whose family survived bankruptcy during the Depression and who invested very well after he came west, was an outspoken progressive. Over 4 decades, he was instrumental in persuading the Greek military junta to release a friend, former Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou, raised funds to defend Daniel Ellsberg when Ellsberg was charged with leaking the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War, helped urge Yasser Arafat, the PLO chairman, to recognize Israel, which jump-started the Oslo peace process, and as president of the L.A. Police Commission and a vocal civil libertarian, he oversaw the campaign to oust Chief Daryl Gates after the beating of Rodney King. Stanley Sheinbaum's most famous or infamous venture was gathering a delegation of American Jewish leaders in 1988 to persuade Arafat to disavow terrorism and recognize Israel. After he was photographed with his arm around Arafat, "For a while, I was the most hated Jew in America by other Jews anyway," Sheinbaum later said. But the encounter paved the way for Arafat's handshake with Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin of Israel at the White House in 1993. "I did it for Israel," Sheinbaum said. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guests this morning, food writers Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Koh. Their new book is called A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. Really interesting and kind of diverse foodography of America in a critical period of its history. Jane Ziegelman is the author of 97 Orchard, An Edible History of Five Immigrant Families in One New York Tenement, which won a number of awards. She curates food-themed events for the Tenement Museum, the famous Tenement Museum in New York. Andrew Koh wrote Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States, which is a finalist for the James Beard Award. Both of them have appeared on a variety of TV documentaries and movie documentaries about food and live with their children in Brooklyn. You know, I always think about Jewish food, which people rave about how wonderful it is, but it's usually made from like the cheapest cuts of meat cooked for the longest period of time. It was kind of a cuisine of poverty. It's always seemed to me that anyway. Is that true? And how does that interact with the Depression?
I would say that, yes, that is true. Although I would make a little adjustment. The heavy meat-centered part of the Jewish diet is something which developed only when Jews made it to the United States. Back in the old country, meat was maybe a once-a-week specialty food that you would eat on the Sabbath. And the rest of the week was bread and potatoes, and
cabbage and
yeah, exactly.
Beets, root vegetables, things
right.
like that.
So although, I mean, I think you are correct that once Jews did have access to meat, they continued to cook with a certain kind of frugality and did buy the cheapest cuts. But I would also argue maybe some of the most flavorful cuts.
You know, there's that famous Yiddish song, Muntik Bulbis, you know, Monday potatoes, Tuesday potatoes, so on. And then, you know, the big special on Shabbat is a potato kugel. You know, you make that point in A Square Meal, you guys, about how suddenly everything became this kind of loaf and that kind of loaf in the Depression. Can you explain that a little?
Well, one of the real challenges for American women cooking during the Depression was figuring out a way to feed their family that was not centered around meat, which was traditionally the centerpiece of the American dinner table. And they looked to various kinds of protein substitutes, like beans and nuts, and then organ meats, the cheaper cuts of meat like liver and kidneys. And they found that one way to pull all these ingredients together into a kind of entree was to prepare loaf dishes. So these were kind of like loaves, but minus the meat. So you had ground peas and ground beans bound together with egg and breadcrumbs and maybe cracker crumbs packed into a loaf pan, baked, and then sliced and served with some kind of gravy. So this was the Depression-era approximation of a meatloaf.
What novelties in the Depression have we carried forward up through today?
There's not so many foods that that were introduced during the Great Depression, at least sort of the home economics budget foods. that we still eat today, because, I mean, those were foods of poverty, and we sort of threw them off and put them into the past as soon as we could, particularly after World War II. But I think the thing that really has continued since the Great Depression is a way of thinking about food. And that is, before the Depression, we ate to fill our stomachs and to satisfy ourselves. But during the Great Depression, because of A, the lack of money, and B, the home economics movement and the big new emphasis on nutrition, we really, you know, ever since, we think very, very, very carefully about the nutritional contents of our food, and we get very worried if we realize that we're not getting enough nutrition in our diet. So that kind of nutrition consciousness clearly comes from the experience of the Great Depression.
You know, there's a very interesting passage in your book about the bonus army. And you know, some of the socialites try to bring food out to them and realize the scope of feeding 20,000 or however many hungry people was beyond what any local charitable experience could take care of. How have we taken those lessons to heart in the course of dealing? How did we do it in the Depression, and how do we carry that forward today?
Well, that's a big question. And one of the things we realized in the early years of the Great Depression is that local governments and charitable organizations and, you know, rich people who were feeling generous weren't enough. That the unemployment problem and the hunger problem was way too big for just local groups to handle. And so this was the first time that the federal government became involved in feeding the unemployed and feeding the hungry. And this, of course, was during the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Herbert Hoover refused to. More or less ever since, we've given a role to the federal government in feeding the unemployed, but never without political debate. One of the strange things, and I guess to us disappointing things, is that the same kind of arguments that people argued over about feeding the hungry back in the 1930s are repeated again and again today. When you read in newspaper reports or about what's happening in Washington, people still can't agree that at least some hungry people should be fed. I think we have a lot to work on still.
What was the worst recipe you uncovered in preparing a square meal?
I'll go for that one. It was a dish that used a nutritional compound invented during the Depression called milk corno, which was a mixture of dried skimmed milk and cornmeal that you could mix with water into a kind of mush. And this was used as a base for chop suey. And the chop suey with milk corno idea, I didn't come across anything else to equal that in sort of strangeness.
That just sounds horrifying. Maybe it's nutritious, but although you did also, I think there's an onion filled with peanut butter.
Those are the kinds of combinations that home economists were attracted to, because it was a way to get these cheap proteins together with a cheap vegetable. So, yeah, that was very much in the spirit of home economics cookery.
In the course of exploring this, what did you learn that surprised you the most?
Well, I think one of the things that surprised me the most was, I just said that FDR decided that the federal government should now be given the role of feeding the hungry. But that only lasted about 2.5 years. And beginning in January 1 of 1936, the federal government stopped feeding the hungry by and large. And he turned his back on the hungry and said it's now up to state governments and local governments. And so, the early years of the Great Depression were, we know as in the sort of common history, as the hungry years. But what a lot of people don't know is that in the last third of the Great Depression, between 1936 and 1940, we had another Hungry Years. And this was under FDR. And people were hungry, and people starved to death. And FDR could have done something about it, but he refused to. He said it's not the federal government's responsibility. And that, you know, changed my opinion of FDR.
You know, you talk about, it's no surprise that Herbert Hoover continued to eat in a dinner jacket and have elegant meals in the White House. And the public relations aspect of Eleanor Roosevelt choosing a really horrible cook for the White House was effective. But it does seem like it was not so easy to keep people's attention on those Americans who were starving to death. Was it really, did people change their eating habits as soon as World War II happened and the economy began to pick up?
During World War II, they couldn't actually go back or change their eating habits that much, because you suddenly had something called the Office of Price Administration, and you had rationing.
Right.
So the federal government controlled what kind of food that people were able to get. So they couldn't get like a steak or something like that, even though that now they could probably afford it, because all the good meat and other, you know, rich protein, rich foods were going to soldiers and were going to our allies in Western Europe. But as soon as World War II came to an end and rationing came to an end, I mean, people said, you know, they'd been eating the lean, you know, the pork cuts and the variety meats for too long, and they decided we want steak, we want hamburger. And that's really when America became like a steak-centric country. Before people did eat beef, but not as much as they did afterward.
Yeah, it always seemed to me that like the goal was a chicken dinner on Sunday up until the Depression, and then after World War II, it was steak.
Right, and also, I mean, chicken was big, but the biggest meat of all was pork and pork products. Bacon, ham, all those things were huge, particularly in rural America, because every farmer had a couple of pigs.
You make a really interesting point, both in reviewing the various magazines' approach to home economics, Good Housekeeping, all of those kinds of journals, Ladies' Home Journal. You talk about that a lot, but you make a really interesting point near the end of your book about the fact that the food authorities who led America through the Depression were overwhelmingly white Anglo-Saxon women, and they reflected that culture. How did that affect the food?
Well, I think it was a period when that sort of Anglo-Saxon cooking sensibility really took hold in this country in a big way and became, in some ways, our national cuisine. It's not as if various immigrant populations...
Kind of a great tragedy, if you think about it. Anglo-Saxons are known for many wonderful things, but food is not one of them.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the food itself is... maybe a little stodgy, and the sort of attitudes toward eating are also, Anglo-Saxons typically believe that in traditional culture, that we shouldn't enjoy ourselves too much. So
that's certainly true in England when you eat the food, so yeah, I can
right,
see that.
Take that attitude to the table. The outcome is not terrific.
There was a definite lack of gusto in the kind of food that they served.
And, you know, it's a very interesting book, A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. I want to thank Andrew Coe and Jane Siegelman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And is there a website people can go to find out more?
A Square Meal has a Facebook page.
Even better. So just search A Square Meal, and you'll get the Facebook page. And I do recommend that you're very careful on which one of the recipes from this book you use.
Handle with care.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday here on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Michael Krasny, author of the new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Jewish Humor and All It Means. Our playout this morning comes for the coming High Holy Days, Barosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, it's written on Yom Kippur, it is sealed. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.